We're not ready yet. I'd like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated to my left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babich, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. Now, we will have the second case, State versus Hamden, and arguing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. Hamden, is Paul F. Lynn of Michael Best. Counsel?
Actually, that changed, Your Honor. My name's Chris Trebatoski. I'm also from the same law firm.
Oh, and I'm arguing on behalf of... You're on the brief, aren't you?
Well, no, I'm not. I actually have spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks learning this very interesting area of the law.
And I'm how are you doing?
Well, you know, I'm after listening to the argument this morning, I'm starting to wonder that myself. I must call my mother and tell her to take the gun safe back that she sent to me for Christmas. Because otherwise, I'm in violation of the law when I store my hunting weapons at home. But let me start with this principle, and I think it fits very well within the context of this case. We've heard a lot of discussion about there are all sorts of technical ways that somebody could be prosecuted, but don't worry, we're not going to prosecute you for that. Well, I think Mr. Hamden is going to say, wait a minute, let's worry about the technicalities. I'm a Palestinian immigrant in the United States after September 11th. Do you think if me, Chris Trebatoski, sort of the white male person, can walk down Capitol Drive with a gun on his hip, as the state is saying, you think that Mr. Hamden, a Palestinian immigrant, is ever going to be in that circumstance? I don't think so. But in this case, I think the Hamden case presents a number of issues. I think specifically that the constitutional question as it relates to the carrying concealed weapons law, under any standard of scrutiny, the statute as it exists and it is currently applied by the body of case law that has developed prior to the constitutional amendment is unconstitutional on its face and in application. There is simply no way to effectively have the right to protect yourself for security, for defense, for hunting, and for other lawful purposes with the concealed weapons law as an effective absolute ban on the carrying of concealed weapons. And that's what we have. Now, I think that there are stepped approaches that can be taken to this question, to this issue. One of them is, does the court have to say it's unconstitutional, legislature, go fix it? Now, well, I may believe that that is ultimately what is the case here, that the legislature has and the people of the state of Wisconsin have by their actions said, this is a broad-based grant of a fundamental right. Do we have to get there to solve the problem? And I think the answer is no. And let me...
Before you go on, if we were to say that, do you have any idea how many CCW prosecutions have occurred since the adoption of this amendment in 1998?
I do not. I don't have the specific statistics on that. But I can't say that. It struck me as this is the sixth time I've been in front of this court, that to have five misdemeanor cases on concealed weapons in a four-year period would create at least a thought in my mind that this is an issue that really needs to get resolved so that it doesn't keep coming back up here. Because it seems to me that if you look at the facts of the case that we have here, even the police officers at the scene didn't know if Mr. Hamden had committed a crime. They disagreed with each other. They didn't arrest him. They went to the DA. The DA made a charging decision. And I think that law enforcement within the state is entitled to more direction than that. More direction right now in the context of these cases than a series of cases in the Court of Appeals that say, well, you know, under some circumstances, it's going to be a privilege to carry a concealed weapon, but we haven't seen it yet, so we don't know what it is. And what I believe is inherent in the constitutional amendment is the constitutional amendment says when there's a privilege to carry a concealed weapon. At a minimum, that's what it says. And I believe that one of the ways to deal with both the facial problems and the as-applied problems with respect to the concealed weapon law in the state without having to declare the statute unconstitutional and without having to force this court and courts of appeals around the state to case-by-case dissect these prosecutions is to use the same group of people who ultimately passed this legislation, who the people or the voters of the state of Wisconsin, to decide when, beyond a reasonable doubt, a concealed weapon is not being carried for the purpose of security, defense, hunting, recreation, or some other lawful purpose. It seems to me that, by making it a jury question in the case, by saying, here's the concealed weapons statute. It says it's unlawful to carry a concealed weapon. Privilege exists as a defense. Section 939.456, which basically had been read out of these cases absent consideration of the constitutional impact, I think has to be read to say at a minimum this constitutional amendment puts the very same wording back into this statute, if it is constitutional, that existed prior to 1878 when the law was changed to say you could not carry a concealed weapon to defend yourself. I think the legislature has spoken, I think the people of the state of Wisconsin have spoken, and I think that it is not necessarily a rule that has to be applied in a black and white nature. I think that it is different for a shopkeeper on 24th and Capitol who has had to use a gun, who has been shot at himself, to carry a concealed weapon in his store than it might be for a shopkeeper in Brookfield.
Well, let me just interrupt you one moment. So what you're saying, if I understand it, the state statute would remain constitutional. The court would issue a ruling, this is a constitutional statute, as a reasonable interpretation and application of the new constitutional amendment, and what we're going to do is withdraw our cases that say no self-defense privilege. And therefore, what we will now say is within that statute there is a self-defense privilege, and it's up to the defendant whether he or she wants a judge or jury, right?
That's correct.
You're not going to mandate a jury.
That's correct.
All right. So is that what you're telling? Is that what you're saying?
I am saying
that how we should write the opinion?
I am saying that that is the only way that I can see the statute surviving. I'd say that absent that, the statute fails on its face.
Well, would you allow self-defense for instance, in this case, because there was no particularized self-defense here in terms of somebody walking in the store and Mr. Homden pulls out a gun to stop an armed robbery, but he just keeps one there.
Do you allow that
to be a self-defense, just the keeping of it?
Well, see, I think that the wording of the statute itself is important in that regard because concepts of self-defense within the statute which defines what self-defense is different from the words bearing a gun for security, which certainly is broader than defense, or why would it be in the provision? And I think that the word defense in and of itself is broader than self-defense, because we have this question that has been argued today, is this an individual or a collective right? And I think my answer to that question is it's both.
So you would allow then, so long as a jury or finder of fact would agree that there was a reasonable belief for the fear of one's own safety, you would allow that as a defense to the statute?
I believe that yes, the answer to that is yes. I think that, in fact, in this situation, that given the constitutional amendment, if this statute's going to pass constitutional scrutiny, that every case where there's a concealed weapon, where there isn't some clearly unlawful purpose, for example, a drug deal with a concealed weapon, that it will be necessarily a defense. Because it's pretty hard to argue right now when our own national government has color-coded defense levels, when there's beltway snipers, when there's anthrax in the mail. It's hard to argue that people aren't insecure, because they are.
So then your real point is that the carry concealed weapon, although constitutional, really provides a defense for everybody unless the person has an unlawful purpose, because there are incidents in courtrooms all over the country with some frequency. Therefore, I would think, a reasonable belief of fear of my own safety. Sitting right here.
I think that depends, Justice Abramson, on what the rules are in terms of carrying guns in the courtroom. I mean, I believe that in the event that there is a decision made that says that people are banned from carrying guns in the courtroom, which seems to me to make imminent sense, that would be a good thing, and then there would be a different need for security. But in the
why in the courtroom and not on State Street?
Well, in my view, to answer the question a step further, even in light of protections in the courtroom, if you go into Milwaukee County and you're in the drug court, you've got bulletproof glass, you've got officers with weapons. So even in those situations, the safety isn't certainly not assured. And would it be wrong for a judge in that case to have a gun on the bench? Now, whether you or I would have a gun there, I'd say is a different issue. But is it illegal to do that today? I'd say it is. Is it wrong? I don't think so.
Counsel, in your brief, you employed the five factors of the Coleman test, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
And it seems to me your response to the chief was a bit broader than the five factors of the Coleman test. Specifically, I looked to factor number one when you're talking about the criteria to exercise this privilege of self-defense. Criteria number one is the defendant was under an unlawful, present, imminent, and impending threat of such a nature as to induce a well-grounded apprehension of death or serious bodily injury. Now, your hypothetical of someone coming into the courtroom and not necessarily being under present, imminent, and impending threat seems inconsistent with the argument that the five factors of Coleman should be employed.
Well, I think that one of the issues that's presented here is that it's a very difficult, in my view, a very difficult line to draw as to once you go away from an absolute ban on the concealed weapon, where do you draw the line? And one of the problems that I had in terms of reading the brief and in arguing this position is that it seems to me that it makes no sense for a felon who cannot possess a gun at all to have a privilege to pull out a gun because some bad guys have previously gone in and tried to beat him up when there's a no-knock search. That seems to me that seems to me to be the case where if a cop's going to get shot, that's when it's going to happen. But the courts have refused to extend the Coleman privilege to carrying concealed weapons, which I don't understand. My belief is that it is a logical extension to do that, but I believe that with the constitutional amendment, that you really do have broader than just the Coleman self-defense standard, because you have questions about security, and especially security in high crime areas, in your home, in your place of business, perhaps even on the street. I mean, my view of this is that when you take the Nolley case, for example, and I realize that these concepts of imminent danger, the fact of the matter is, in an imminent danger situation, if you take it to the extreme, nobody's going to have the concealed weapon. They're going to have it out and point it at somebody.
The requirement of imminence is connected to the self-defense presupposition of use of force or threat of force in self-defense. That's why the law requires imminent dangerousness, because the self-defense defense arises when the defendant has actually used or threatened to use force. It's not a good fit with a status crime like CCW or felon in possession.
Well, no, I agree with that. I mean, I agree with your point. I mean, the idea of trying to figure out how privilege fits into a strict liability offense like carrying a concealed weapon, to me, says the better approach is, while I don't understand in terms of completely what we have here and how you draw the distinction between Coleman and the Hamden case, for example, because the underlying facts are nearly the same, except the police walked in and asked him, do you have a gun, in the process of a license check. They didn't bust the door down, in which case the gun probably would have been drawn, and then we don't have a concealed weapons issue.
And they seem to put a lot of, the state seems to talk about, or at least maybe you could straighten this out, factually, this gun was wrapped in plastic there's no, I think, prescribed methodology of how you carry a gun if it's encased, whether it's wrapped in a, put in a bag, whether it's in a case, and there are all kinds of different cases. Was this like a Ziploc bag? What was this wrapped in, this gun?
I can't answer that question. I can tell you that it was wrapped in plastic. The plastic was destroyed by the police. So at the time that we were hired in this case, we can't tell you exactly what kind of plastic it was in that gun.
But he was transporting, as I understand it, he was closing for business. He was transporting the gun from place A to place B. Is that?
That is correct. He was moving the gun. He put the gun in plastic into his pocket to take it from what's been described as the non-public area of his store to another non-public area of his store to put it in a safe, which is also a concealed weapon. But
the state is arguing that the standard, the proper standard here, is a reasonable standard, and the state is saying that it's not unreasonable for one to not to have a concealed weapon in your home. And we've listened to all the members of this court have characterized some of the more unusual examples which you stated yourself of having guns locked up. The point of the matter that I want to get to is that it doesn't seem to me to be reasonable to assume that if you are going to move a gun from place A to place B in your own place of business or your residence, that you can't carry it in your pocket or have it in your hand. They seem to say they wouldn't have charged him if he had the gun in his hand, but because he had it in his pocket, wrapped up, then that was
not reasonable, that was unreasonable. This seems to be very bizarre.
I agree with you, too. My view of it is that you have a situation where the state says, look, hey, if it was just under the counter, we're not going to charge him. Well, then how do you explain the Mata case? Because that's where the gun was. And if it's just in his house, well, we're not going to charge him, but this is a place where his children ate and their grandmother cooked for them. Yeah, that's pretty close to a house. This is a case where you're moving the gun from an area where it will be secured while the store is closed so that it is unlikely to be stolen from an area where it's out in the open. And what it does, I think, is it highlights the problem that people have. That is, people don't know what they can and can't do right now with firearms, and the police don't know what they can and can't do in terms of charging, and prosecutorial discretion here is absolute. And when you make all of those, when all of those situations exist, and you have a constitutional amendment that says that you have the right to use a weapon for security, you have a right to use a weapon for defense, then all of those technicalities consume the statute, in my view. They just create a totally unworkable legal system.
But under your theory, and I think your theory is that, correct me if I'm wrong, that you can carry a gun so long as it's not for an unlawful purpose. Is that your theory?
That's correct.
I mean, then we've got an armed society, and anybody can carry a gun. I suppose you could make some exceptions for convicted felons or whatever. You'd have an armed society, wouldn't you?
Well, it is a possibility that you would have an armed society, yes. Mm-hmm. And then that's a question.
Well, isn't then, if I can go back a step, isn't it better to postulate a principle of law that there has to be somewhat of a specific but reasonably held belief of fear for one's own safety, which I concede Mr. Hamdan had here?
Well, in the question then becomes, who makes the decision? Is it a decision that's a question of law for the court, or is it a decision that's a question of law for the jury? And my point is that regardless of how you structure that should be a jury question. And in this particular context, I think that there is a risk that you arm society. I really do believe that that's the case. But the solution to that problem is not to squeeze the life out of the constitutional amendment. It's when we have a governor-elect who's coming in who was outspokenly opposed to this. We have a situation where he will be empowered shortly to call a special legislative session if he needs to address these issues. And so that it's pretty safe to say that if that happens, if this court just says no, it's done, that's exactly what will happen. But I think that this is a perfect opportunity for the court to allow all the branches of government to work on this issue, because I think that it is one that is very difficult for the court alone to work on, because there's legislative issues, there are executive issues, there are safety issues that are involved. But as this case demonstrates, it is inappropriate, in my view, to leave the discretion where it is now because the wrong decisions are being made.
Also, if we're really looking to give guidance to law enforcement and to normal people in terms of what they can or cannot do, why should we leave it to a jury in every individual case? Why shouldn't we have the legislature set the rules, tell us what is and is not a lawful purpose?
Well, in this instance, this right or privilege, if it's given to the jury, is given to the same electors who voted in favor of this particular amendment.
But then you have determinations made on a case-by-case-by-case basis, rather than some broad guidelines enacted by the legislature.
Well, that is true, but you also have the effect of prosecutors around the state knowing that they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this gun was not carried for one of the enumerated purposes. And I think that what it does is it provides a broader based ability to administer judicially the statute immediately without having to rely upon legislative action if the concern is we're going to have an armed society and that is something that's unacceptable. Because giving the jury the decision as to whether or not someone is truly carrying a gun for the purposes of security or defense or for hunting, it's going to have a direct impact on prosecutorial decisions. It's going to have direct impact on what the judge has to decide after the evidence is presented in its entirety and after the jury has had an ability to consider it. It seems to me that it's a middle ground that allows this court to maintain the integrity of a concealed weapons concept. Okay. Or give life to the amendment at the same time.
I want to make sure I understand if your theory were applied. Let's take the facts of the last case where someone is driving as a passenger in a car and he has a gun in the gun department, in the glove compartment, and under the seat. And he was beaten up 13 years before or something to that effect. I had this for self-defense. Who proves what in a jury trial?
In this instance, my belief is that the state would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not carried for that purpose.
And that it wasn't carried for an unlawful purpose.
Some other unlawful purpose.
And that he had a reasonable belief of fear of one's own safety.
If that is the definition of defense.
That's the one you're proposing.
I think that it's broader. I think it's somewhat broader than that because you have the security question, and I think that there has to be some reasonableness in the use of it for security. Or do you have to have a reasonable belief that you have to have the gun for security or defense?
Well, it seems to include the exercise of this right. For example, in the suburbs, which perhaps don't have the same crime problems in the central city. And if you're living in a crime-free neighborhood, if you define it that way.
It could possibly do that.
I don't read this constitutional amendment as having any jurisdictional limitations on it within the state.
See, and I would say that my view of the constitutional amendment is that it either is just plain, the statute is just plain unconstitutional, it has to be, and you have to, the legislature has to go back and start from scratch. Or, if you're going to try to save it and not do that, then I'm suggesting this as an alternative. I think my primary argument would be, and I would be here, and it would take about 30 seconds, and that is the carrying concealed weapon law on its face because it's absolute unconstitutional, period. Sit down.
Is that your first alternative?
Yes.
And your second one is to try and save it?
Well, my second one is to say, in this instance, as applied, we've got to come up with a way to not criminalize what Mr. Hamden did.
Well, come up with a way that your gun is working one's criminal business, that would not be a violation.
That would certainly be one way to do it.
Are you pro bono?
Yes.
Mr. Hamden does not have to be an attorney.
That's correct.
Would the 16-year-old pizza driver also be able to assert self-defense?
Well, I think in that situation that the state could legislate to control weapons with children. It does so in the hunting context right now with required training or you could create a situation where a 16-year-old with proper training and a permit could carry a weapon if that was a legislative decision to do that, or it could be banned saying you're a child, you're not allowed to carry it, you're adult, period. It could be handled either way. That's a legislative question. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Castle.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. In contrast to the Cole case that was just argued, the defendant in this case, Mr. Hamdan, does not argue, or at least he had not argued until a few minutes ago, that the CCW statute was facially invalid. Rather, his argument has been that the statute should not be applied to his conduct as a matter of statutory construction, that his conduct was privileged under Section 939.45, and that if the CCW statute does apply to his conduct, that statute is unconstitutional as applied. I think it is essential, therefore, to keep in mind the conduct that formed the basis for Mr. Hamdan's conviction, because as applied challenges look to the specific conduct of the person who is making the as-applied challenge rather than to someone else. The state's theory, as alleged in the criminal complaint and as the prosecutor told the jury in his opening statement and closing arguments, was that Mr. Hamdan violated the concealed weapons law when he carried a pistol concealed in his pocket. The evidence at trial showed that two Milwaukee police officers entered the defendant's store at 8:15 p.m. to conduct a license check. When they entered, the store lights were on, the door was unlocked, and some customers had just left the store. The defendant came out from the back area of the store to speak with the officers, and he talked with them for about 15 minutes in the front area of the store, the area frequented by the customers. It was only after that that in response to a question from one of the officers about whether there were any weapons present, that the defendant revealed that he had a gun in his pocket. The issue posed by the as-applied challenge in this case, therefore...
No, the gun was wrapped up.
Well, the testimony, as I understand it, was that it was a piece of plastic, and my reading of the testimony was that it was like a single sheet that the gun was, it was wrapped around this way, so it wasn't tied up with a rubber band or anything that would have, there was nothing to suggest that there was anything to hinder access to it, that it was just
a Ziploc bag.
It wasn't in the Ziploc bag.
Who can open those?
Most days I can. So the question posed by this case is not whether the defendant violated the statute when he had the gun under the counter. And it certainly is not whether the statute is violated by keeping a gun in the home in a safe. Rather, the only question, the specific question posed by this case, is whether the defendant in this case had the right, either under the CCW statute or the privilege statutes or the Constitution, to carry a gun in his pocket in the public area of his store while he was speaking with the officers.
I believe you would concede the constitutional amendment would have the right to carry the weapon in his hand in his store.
Yes.
And so what he should have done is when he was summoned to speak to the police officers was take it out of his pocket and have it in his hand when he went out to have a conversation with them.
He should have said, I've got a gun with me. Can I put it away?
What is
but it's still in his pocket, and it's still a technical violation of the statute. So he had to take it out of his pocket, unwrap it, right, before he would be seen with it by the police officers.
Correct.
And that's a sound legal regime.
Well, I think it we don't know whether had Mr. Hamdan at the point where the police officer said, can we speak to you, said, hold on, I've got to put my gun away, and went and put it away. I think it's pretty unlikely he would have been charged. Could he have been charged? I think under a technical reading of the statute, yes, he could have been.
What's the difference between a technical reading and a violation?
It is a... There's
none.
A technical violation is one that a prosecutor, in the exercise of his discretion, is going to say, that's not really what we're about.
In a real violation, the prosecutor has a similar discretion.
Sure, there are... Yes.
What is the, in the statute itself, 941.23, it talks about going armed. What do you believe going armed means? Is there any difference in going armed, whether you're carrying it in your hand or you're carrying it in your pocket?
No, I think at the very least, even before the Malarkey case, I think having it on one's person, whether in a pocket or in a hand, was going armed. Now, as I understand the defendant's argument, he is seeking an exemption for place, whether place of one's own place of business.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but in the examples that you said here during both cases, you've heard going armed, does that mean within your reach?
Now, first of all, at least now, that term has been used by this court, the within reach, have all been car cases. It's been Malarkey, Fry, and Esfor.
Shouldn't we distinguish, going armed between a person's home and being in your car? I think it's all the same.
Well, I'm hesitant. I think the strongest justification is in the car setting. And there are times, though, that I think when one can imagine that there would be dangers posed to, for example, police.
Concurrence, I think it was in Perez, about sportsmen, they've got a gun in the case in the back seat of their car, and under the interpretation or whatever, that would be going armed.
That's right. If it's within reach in the back seat. Yes.
Are you finished with Justice Wilcox?
I was just going to point out that I think I mentioned that the Gonzales argument, that it's the position of the DNR that if one is complying with 167.31 and the weapon is both encased and unloaded, that they do not treat that as a CCW.
Counsel, law has to make sense. Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say I have an office at our home in the basement, and it's a large room, and it also contains a locked gun cabinet within my reach while I'm in the office writing opinions and reading briefs. Am I carrying a concealed weapon?
Under the way the court has interpreted the statute so far, yes.
Now, let's say the door of that locked gun cabinet actually has a frame area of glass, so you can see the guns displayed inside. It's locked. You're in a cabinet. Now, as I'm reading my briefs and writing opinions, am I carrying a concealed weapon?
No, you're not. Because it's not concealed.
I want you to know the latter is true.
Well,
there's a glass in that cabinet. But my point is, the point is, I don't want to be a criminal. And I don't want it to depend on whether or not that cabinet happens to have glass in the door or not, because that doesn't make sense to me as I'm writing the opinions and reading my briefs.
And I think were a case ever to come to this court in which it's an as-applied challenge to possession of the home, the court could say, well, maybe the within-reach test doesn't apply within one's home. I don't know that there is necessarily a basis in the statutory language for that. But I think in the appropriate case, that might be the result.
Isn't that an argument for having the legislature fix it?
Well, I don't know. Yes, I mean, I agree that the appropriate, I guess I agree with counsel for Mr. Hamlin that this is an appropriate area for the legislature to deal with. I don't think the way to get the legislature to deal with it is for this court to invalidate a statute that has primarily constitutional applications, because on the fringe one might imagine a prosecution for Justice Bradley she didn't have glass on her gun safe. I mean, we don't have prosecutions for people with guns in their gun safe. I don't think the court should find in the current language of the statute, though, an exception for one's own place of business. The going armed language, for example, defense counsel has argued in his brief, well, going armed means going, therefore it can't be in your home or in your place of business. But going also has another meaning. It can mean being in a state or a condition so that one can go barefoot in one's own home. One can go armed in one's own store.
And under your standard, what is reasonable? Isn't it reasonable to allow this in one's business or home different than the other situations? Why is that reasonable?
I don't know that one necessarily wants to. It's proper to equate home and the business. I think there are vastly different considerations, the way both pro and con, but in the home, there are considerations of there are children around, one doesn't perhaps want guns out where children can get them. In the business, the business owner is coming into contact with public on a regular basis. That's an argument that weighs, I think, both ways, both in allowing concealed weapons in that situation and not allowing them. That's what the court in the Marta case was pointing out, that there are perfectly reasonable arguments that a person should be allowed to carry a concealed weapon in his place of business. But there are also arguments that it is more effective if one is required to carry openly, and that's precisely why it should be the legislature making that difficult call rather than a court, because the constitutional amendment, there is simply nothing in the constitutional amendment that indicates that the purpose of that amendment was to cut back on our existing statute. And certainly there wasn't any doubt at the time this amendment was passed that a business owner carrying a gun in his pocket in his place of business was violating the statute.
Why isn't this a technical violation?
Well, you know, I've used the term technical violation and perhaps been appropriately called on it but I think the question is, why isn't this a violation that shouldn't have been charged? And, you know, there's nothing in the record as to why the district attorney's office decided to proceed with the prosecution here. Again, and I don't know why, that I only can assure the court it was not a decision that was made casually. But I think it was within the range of prosecutorial discretion, given the fact that Mr. Hamlin was out standing for 15 minutes out in the public area of the store, in the customer area of the store, doors are unlocked, lights are on, anyone could have come in.
Now, he wasn't there. I guess the Justice Sykes touched on this, that he was the store hours were 8 o'clock, this was 8:15, but the door was open, the light was on, they went in. But when they first observed him, he was not in the public area.
That's right.
And what you're saying, well, he should have immediately pulled the gun. Well, I was thinking that might have been dangerous for him to have, you know, pulled the gun out of his pocket when the, I assume these were armed with officers that are coming in, and
I think it would have been an unwise move to, without saying anything, simply pull a gun out of his pocket. But had he said, "Officers, I'm putting my gun away. Can you give me a second?"
Well, what are they going to do in that situation? Because they show us their hands, we're coming to get it. You know.
I guess I don't know that.
Mr. Castle, does it make sense?
More than capital in the city of Milwaukee. They're not going to let him get a hold of that gun in that situation.
Well, from what I understand, he has had other interactions with police officers during other incidents where they have.
Or reasons why they wouldn't let that happen.
Castle, I take it you're saying that if that gun was sitting on the counter, there'd be no violation when those police officers came in.
That's correct.
Does that make sense to you, that there's a violation if that gun is sitting on the counter, but there's no violation if that gun is sitting on the counter, but if he happens to have it in his pocket, there is a violation? What's the rational distinction? Where's the common sense?
It's the whole justification for the CCW law is that there are dangers posed by concealed weapons. Now, whether Mr. Hamden, under the facts of this case, was posing a danger to anyone? No. Neither was Mr. Nolley. Neither was Mr. Dunman. The Nolley case, the arrest of Mr. Nolley was 2 blocks away. It was at the intersection of Capitol and 27th. And the court, in that case, said, this may be a dangerous neighborhood. We don't recognize that simply because someone is in a dangerous neighborhood, they have a right.
Was the constitutional amendment in play in that case?
It was not in play. It was in effect, but it was not in play.
That changes everything, right? You have to concede this.
Yes, certainly. It changes.
And as I understand your argument, you're saying the constitutional amendment did not accomplished an abrogation of the legislature's right to enact reasonable gun regulations. You're also saying that the constitutional amendment did not accomplish official repeal or invalidate the CCW statute. You would concede, I assume, that we need to reinterpret, at the very least, the CCW statute in light of the constitutional amendment in order to accommodate the exercise of the right that is contained in the amendment.
I think you might on a case-by-case basis, but I don't know that it is done by withdrawing the language as applied in those, for example, the within reach case. I would not concede, for example, that in the case of a car, that language needs to be withdrawn.
How would you propose that we reinterpret the statute in order to accommodate the constitutional right, which confers, we have conceded, an individual right to keep and bear? We have conceded that means possess and carry.
It does. It doesn't mean possess.
How would we reinterpret the statute in order to accommodate the exercise of that right?
Frankly, I don't think that it needs. Under any of the factual scenarios we've dealt with, I think it is perfectly constitutional in the context, for example, of a retail store or business, for the legislature to say, if you want to exercise your constitutional right to bear arms, Mr. Storekeeper, you must keep it in a holster. So I don't think that it is necessary to reinterpret the statute under the facts of this case.
Mr. Castle, I have to tell you that I'm very troubled by the proposition that the law, the statute, irrespective of the Constitution, must be interpreted as saying that you cannot keep a gun in your own home unless it is sort of publicly displayed. This is so patently absurd that I just don't think I... Why should I feel bound by that?
Well, and I think, as I said, when you're talking about do we need to reinterpret this statute, I think in the case of a homeowner, the court may well say the within reach test does not apply.
You talked about the children being at the home. If you had children in the home, wouldn't that be all the more reason that you would put something out of sight?
That's right. Yeah, and as I said, I think in the homeowner case, if one were ever to make it to this court, which, as I said, it's kind of hard to imagine a homeowner being prosecuted for a gun in the...
Well, let me just say, the state's theory, or you, what you're saying in response to Justice Prosser, is that that would be a reasonable exception, what you explained. But in the business, you're saying that if the gun is in the pocket or he's carrying it, that's concealed. But if it was laying, it was on the, just on the counter, but it was what, within or without his reach?
Wouldn't matter.
Wouldn't make any difference. Right. But if it's there, then that would not be a violation of the law. And it's just, again, not to echo what Justice Prosser indicated, but that seems to be, from a safety standpoint, just almost inconceivable that you would have, because that gun would be accessible to not only the owner of the business, but other people.
Well, and that's why carrying in a holster is an alternative. It may not be one that the store owner prefers. Clearly wouldn't.
The issue before us is not whether the carrying a concealed weapon is sound in all of its applications. That was a legislative policy. We have interpreted it, and maybe some of our decisions are not so sound. But you're saying the decisions so far that apply in these fact situations should not be changed, and that they are not only reasonable or rational in terms of concealed weapon, but they fit a reasonable test under the Constitution.
That's right.
That's your position.
Because
what's the matter with taking the position that the defendant takes? That is, that you instruct a jury that carrying a concealed weapon is a violation of the law unless it's for one of these purposes in the Constitution. Two, it is not for any unlawful purpose, so we get rid of the bank robber. And three, the person has a reasonable belief that he's bearing arms, keeping and bearing arms, for one of the purposes, security, defense, he's going hunting, recreation, he shoots in the backyard, whatever. Okay? What's the matter with that? Isn't that a nice compromise?
It swallows the CCW statute. Because the purpose of the CCW statute was not just to prohibit people carrying concealed weapons for unlawful purposes, but to prohibit generally carrying concealed weapons because of the risk they pose in unforeseen circumstances. Someone who...
Well, the alternative swallows the constitutional amendment, does it not?
The alternative of not changing the statute?
Right. I mean, doesn't Mr. Hamden, isn't he entitled to defend against this charge on the basis of the constitutional right that he has?
I don't think he had a constitutional right to carry a concealed weapon, no, because I think he...
He has a constitutional right to...
Carry a weapon.
...bear arms for security or defense, which is what he's asserting this was for.
Right. And this statute limits the manner in which he can do that. It says if he wants to carry it with him, it should be in a holster.
Now, our job, of course, is not to interpret the law based upon our own personally held beliefs, or whether we would have voted for this in the legislature, or whether we voted for it as a constitutional amendment. Our job is to interpret the amendment.
Right.
And you said that the interpretation put forth by the defendant and repeated by Justice Abrams and myself is that it swallows the CCW statute. But isn't that the very fear that was expressed when this was being passed, and expressed publicly in editorials around the state, expressed by members of the legislature, that in fact, if this passed, it was going to swallow the statute?
Well, there were some fears of that, yes. And there are other fears that it would just lead to endless litigation without expressing a prediction on the outcome.
But I mean, if the people of this state believed when they were passing this that they were essentially swallowing CCW, it's not our job to say that people were wrong.
But to reach that conclusion, you would say that the fears and dire predictions of the opponents of the measure determines what the intent of the legislature, voters were. In my brief in the Cole case, I cited United States Supreme Court decision of how dangerous that is. That creates a great potential for mischief if you let the opponents of a measure dictate the interpretation. If you look at what the framers, the supporters, beginning with the very first drafter's note, which alerts the members of the legislature that the right to bear arms amendments in other states has universally been interpreted as a limited rather than absolute right subject to reasonable regulation, and that one of those reasonable regulations is a prohibition on carrying a concealed weapon. And you see that carried through into other statements by the legislative support bodies that this is not going to invalidate any current weapons
but
legislation.
I
don't see how you can get to the conclusion that the intent was to do what it said. And
well, I see in this record, or at least in one of the briefs, I don't remember which one, that one of the major newspaper editorials in the state said that this was a very real danger of passing this. And I've seen nothing in this record to indicate that anybody stood up and said, no, it's...
Actually, there is something in the record that at that same time...
Okay,
the
I missed it. What?
It was Speaker Jensen, the author of the amendment, said, this will not invalidate any existing laws. The purpose is to prevent unreasonable regulations like the Madison handgun ordinance, but it will not... invalidate any existing law. So when the primary sponsor of the measure says that, I think that's a pretty strong statement of intent. We also look at getting back to the method of interpreting constitutional amendments, looking to contemporaneous legislative actions. As I pointed out in my brief, the sponsors of the concealed carry legislation that was introduced after the amendment passed was a virtual overlap with sponsors of the constitutional amendment. That legislation, I think the sponsors would be surprised to find out, was not imposing restrictions on CCW, on a CCW law that had been repealed, but it was allowing CCW, and it even included an opt-out provision. It had an opt-out to allow county boards by a two-thirds vote to opt out of issuing permits. And that, I think, is wholly incompatible with the idea that the constitutional amendment created a right to carry a concealed weapon. If the legislature at the same time is saying, counties, you may opt out of the permits system.
Could you tell us how you react to your opposing counsel's suggestion that whenever an argument is made that one of the purposes is served, it becomes a jury question.
I think the reaction of some of the members of the court was appropriate, that I don't think the purpose is to have the amendment asserted to have this be determined by a jury on a case-by-case basis. I think that there can be claims raised on a case-by-case basis of unconstitutionality as applied. But I think that's a legal question rather than a factual question for the jury, because to do that would be, say, the Constitution rewrites our privilege statutes. The court has...
Her argument is it does not.
It does not. The court has no further questions. So thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Castle. Counsel?
It seems to me that the state's position in this case is extreme, bordering on the absurd, and let me explain why I say that. What the state is saying is constitutional rights have to be granted on a case-by-case basis by the legislature, and I think that's exactly opposite of what it is. We have a constitutional right now in this state to possess and carry our weapons for very specific reasons. Now, the legislature could, under appropriate restricted means, control who has those weapons to, for example, keep them out of the hands of felons or children, or maybe to require permitting of those weapons. But that's not what we have. What we have is an argument that's just the opposite. It is the trust me, I'm here from the government, I'm here to help you. And in this instance, we keep hearing, well, that case is on the fringe, this case is on the fringe, but Mr. Hamden's not on the fringe. And if Mr. Hamden is not on the fringe, then every single person in this state that has a gun has to be at risk that they're not on the fringe either. If Mr. Hamden says, officer, I have a pistol in my pocket, and that officer knows Mr. Hamden's already used that in self-defense to shoot and kill a robber in his store, which I guarantee you those police officers did, Mr. Hamden wouldn't have to worry about a misdemeanor. He'd either be in jail or dead if he pulled that gun out. And it would be a justifiable use of force if he pulled that gun out to do that, I think. Now, what are we creating when the state says, well, all that you have to do is follow MATA. Let's have these guns hanging up on the walls in the store. Let's have somebody have it on a holster. You're telling storekeepers in the inner city of Milwaukee at that point, every criminal knows, because the Supreme Court said so, that the only way there can be a gun in this store is if you see it. If you don't see a gun, this store is free reign. Go in and get them. Not only that, if you have somebody carrying a gun on a holster, what do you think happens? That person gets shot. The way to make it safer, the way that the deterrent really works, is if the criminal going into the store just plain doesn't know is there a gun there or not, and takes the risk that there is. And in that part of the city, I would suggest to you that there's not a single person in this room who would run a store that didn't have a gun, especially if their children were going to be there, or their mother or grandmother. It just is not going to happen.
So when the person goes into the store to rob it, they have a 50-50 shot of whether the gun is there. They would shoot and then ask questions, or you think they'll be deterred from going in? Is that
your
point?
I'm not sure that the argument on deterrence, whether it be in MATA or in this case, has anything to do if somebody's on drugs, they're going to go, okay?
Let's eliminate deterrence. So.
But what I'm saying is that the storekeeper's level of safety is higher if the criminal doesn't know whether or not there's a gun there than if there's one openly displayed.
So maybe the criminal ought to go in like this and say, I'm not armed, I hope you're not either, but you give me your money anyway.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, but that points out the counter to that is it points out the absurdity to the storekeeper having to keep the gun in the open too, saying, here, criminal, here's my gun, come in and shoot me before you rob me. Because the store operator still has the option to make a decision if he's got a concealed weapon as to whether or not he's just going to give up the money, or if he believes that the threat is at such a degree that he has no choice but to pull the gun out.
If he has a reasonable belief in his own personal safety.
Yes, and I think that as it's presented here, look, we've got a statute that's so messed up that based on all of these technicalities, based on all of these arguments, that if it was me and I was sitting in my ivory tower in Milwaukee, I'd say, get rid of the thing. Legislature, do your job. Fix it. But, you know, from a practical standpoint, I think that there's an alternative here, and that is let the people who pass this decide. And I'll tell you, you know, I was thinking about the question Justice Sykes raised about whether or not if you live in Brookfield or Whitefish Bay, where I live, that it makes a difference about carrying a concealed weapon. But you know what? I'll tell you what. I'll take my chance in front of a Waukesha County jury any time if I'm representing somebody from Brookfield who says they feel that their safety is at issue. That jury isn't going to convict them, and I don't think even in Waukesha County they're going to get prosecuted for that.
If the jury's not going to convict, why go through the charade? Why don't we just eliminate the statute?
Well, because I think that there are that every defendant then is going to claim I was carrying it for that purpose. I don't think that's reasonable either, because I don't think that is true necessarily. I think the credibility of the defendant in advancing the defense is important, and I think it's good for the administration of justice. People then have to think about why they carry their gun. They have to go into court, and they have to prove, or the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that didn't happen, but it is just not Joe Blow saying, I'm carrying a gun. It's people thinking about it. And if they're thinking about it, their chances of using it for road rage or one of the other horribles that the state has come up with, it's different. If you're thinking about it, if you're consciously doing it, and you know that if you could get prosecuted, if people don't believe you, that's a good result, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments this morning and listening to the first argument, counsel.